As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business. Joining me today are The Times' very own Gary Jacob and Martin Hardy. And for those wondering where Natalie Sawyer is, she's sunning it up, but she'll be back, thank God, on Thursday. Coming up on today's show, we'll be looking back on Celtic's Old Firm victory on Sunday with The Times' Scottish football writer, Michael Grant. But first, a helter-skelter North London derby on Sunday left Hearts racing, but plenty of questions about the progress of Unai Emery and Mauricio Pochettino's side. Spurs took a two-goal lead through Christian Eriksen and Harry Kane from the penalty spot, thanks to some calamitous Arsenal defending. Alexander Lacazette pulled one back before the break, finishing emphatically after some equally dodgy defending from Spurs. And Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang poked in Matteo Guendouzi's delicious cross to equalise and get a share of the spoils. Gary, you were at the Emirates yesterday. It was a breathless encounter. Brilliant for the neutral, but pretty chaotic stuff from both sides.
Pretty chaotic. I think when you look at the last 5 minutes, especially in sort of injury time, stoppage time, when both teams were literally 80 yards apart, both going for this for the winner, which it was like a cup tie. And it was like, you know, as Matt Dickinson writes today, it's just like if you're Liverpool, Manchester City, you look at that and going, well, you know, these two teams are just not going to be up there with us at the end of the season. It was so naive, so all their deficiencies were there. Obviously, there were some good points as well, but it just felt like a game that showed why these two aren't really going to close that gap this year. It's just that they felt a little bit immature, defensively suspect. Arsenal have got issues about knowing the balance of the team, and pretty much the tactics seemed to go out the window by half time. Obviously, Tottenham had a game plan to suck Arsenal in and hit them on the break, which was fine, and obviously did the trick. But once it went to 2-1, it was just pure bedlam, really.
Martin, do you think Arsenal have got any chance of finishing third with a central pairing of Socrates and David Luiz?
They're playing football from the front if they are going to succeed in coming third. And I agree with what Gary said there and what Matt alluded to this morning, that it feels like everybody's playing for third place already, because the game that Manchester City and Liverpool are playing is that much ahead of the people that are trying to compete with them. So you've got this interesting take of whether Arsenal can kind of sustain the firepower through Aubameyang and Lacazette and therefore brush over the deficiencies that they showed yet again yesterday. And I never like the phrase when people say it's Sunday league defending, but having coached a couple of years ago under sixes and under sevens, that first goal when Arsenal kind of moving back, it's so chaotic. It looked like children playing football. It's like, does anybody know where they're supposed to be going here? Are you trying to anticipate anything? Is there a structure? Whether that's good enough to finish third may be because there are not a great, it's not a great a bunch of competitors that are trying to break into that top two. See, what have they got? Tottenham, Chelsea, Man United and themselves all seem like they're four teams in a state of flux at the minute, trying to kind of plot a way forward or trying to find a realistic game plan to catch the top two. What might be interesting as well is the teams trying to catch them four. If there's a season to break in the top six, it feels like this might be it, because them four just seem so vulnerable. Even Sissoko might not necessarily have been Tottenham's worst player, and Winks might not be their worst player, but them two in the centre midfield, looking at Tottenham's teams yesterday, you're thinking, how is this evolving stronger? And it feels like it, from the outside, it feels like it isn't. Arsenal's plan seems perhaps sometimes as chaotic as they're defending, because you're still not quite sure what they're trying to do. But can they finish third? It's so open, it's difficult to say.
I think, you know, Gregor, you obviously saw the game. You saw the centre-backs, there's an issue there with Socrates and Luiz, and perhaps almost too similar in terms of neither one's prepared to drop off, and the midfield balance. What do you think, Gregor?
Yeah, I think we could see in the first goal clearly that both Socrates and Luiz were sucked in, but I think unnecessarily. I think if Socrates was going to win that ball, as Sol Campbell said in the studios, you have to win it or you don't go. And then when in fairness, it was good movement from Spurs. I think Lamela peeled off really well and cleverly, but Luiz again was sucked in, and he did the same against Liverpool. So it does seem really, really hard to envisage them keeping enough clean sheets or certainly not conceding many goals in games with those two, that pairing. And we discussed a little bit before, Gary, about the sort of imbalance in midfield. It seems that Emery went to play that front three for kind of the first time, and he thought he'd be a bit more cautious in midfield, but it wasn't the right balance until Ceballos came on and with about an hour gone.
Yeah, I think we at the game, I think everyone looked at the team sheet and said it's all very well, but who's going to play the ball to the front three? So he seemed to be sort of caught trying to be too cautious, and I think he needs to be brave and decide if he's going to play the front three, then he may as well drop Xhaka, because what does Xhaka actually do for him in terms of the team apart from often idiotic behaviour?
Well, let's come to that.
He's got two holders in there. They can protect the back four, and then he needs someone to kind of put the transition to the front three, and it probably needs to be Ceballos or Willock or someone who can do that job. But the way he had it yesterday, it didn't really feel, because he's got David Luiz at the back, and Luiz can play the long balls into a Bangham. If they're going to go long and they're going to go and they're going to put balls into the channels or between the fullback and centre back, then Luiz can do that anyway, and he's probably a better passer of the ball than Xhaka anyway. And I think I think probably Emery's having made Xhaka, he's kind of probably having made Xhaka captain, he's probably now feels he's got to play him. But I think at some stage he's probably going to have to just realise that actually the team needs to involve, and I've kind of, if I'm at the front three going to play, he can't play, so that's going to be a big call. The centre backs will probably change when Holding comes back, I think, and that might be a slightly better combination, Holding and Luiz. Socrates, in the first, I've seen him three times this season, and he's found it difficult in the air. Burnley gave him trouble in the air, Liverpool gave him trouble in the air, and I think he's just poor in the air, so that will probably change. And maybe when when the fullback, and often I've got their fullbacks playing, maybe
they have got improvements to come.
And as have Spurs as well.
What would Emery's preferred formation be, given that that seemed real tactical naivety at Liverpool when he played a narrow diamond against a team that's fullbacks are two of the most creative players in the country? And then it's a big change to go for the three, effectively, kind of up front yesterday. What is his preferred system with the players that he has at Arsenal? Curiosity is looking from the outside. Where are they heading?
It's a good question. I don't think he knows. I don't think he knew last season. He sort of started with the four at the back, then went to a wing back system because he just didn't trust the centre backs. And I think it's the same this year. He just doesn't know. He's got all these new players, and he doesn't know how to kind of fit them all into the same team and what's going to be the best formation. It will probably end up as 4-2-3-1 in some way, but the thing that's noticeable.
How do you accommodate Lacazette?
Well, I think that's the thing that's noticeable, is that Aubameyang doesn't like being out on the left.
No.
He looks much better when he's in tandem with Lacazette. So somewhere along the line, they've got to decide if those two play up front together, how does it work back from those two, and to still get the width, because if they're too narrow, then the fullbacks have to provide the width, and Kolasinac probably could provide width, but he's great going forward, but he's hopeless going back, and he's not going to protect your left back if it's him. When Tierney comes in, it might be different. When Bellerin's back, it might be different. But these are all things that are some way off, and obviously, it's a good question, and I think every Arsenal fan is asking the same question: is that how's this all going to work, and how are you going to find the best of these players? And Pepe looks like he's got glimpses, but he looks like he's going to have to spend time to kind of adjust the game. His final pass yesterday was a little bit poor, or his final shot was scuffed, and I think he just needs a little bit of time to kind of adjust. As it seems,
there's no doubt that that front three is going to be a danger this season. That's just how Emery best sort of arranges his players behind that, and who they are. And obviously, I think we have to touch on Xhaka, because it does seem sort of how it reflects on Arsenal that he is their captain and he's making so many reckless reckless kind of decisions like this. And the fifth penalty he's given away since he joined in 2016-17, which is more than anyone in that time. He is a bit of a liability. And what do you think that does say about Arsenal, that he's their captain, Martin?
I don't know what you're watching that challenge yesterday in such a big game, and your captain can lead by example, but there's got to be a cooler head and a bit more thought process to all of that that goes in. And it's interesting Gary saying that Emery might have backed himself into a corner by making him his captain, so suddenly it's more difficult to leave him out of the team. You just cannot. Arsenal were fortunate to equalise just before, sorry, to pull a goal back just before half time to get themselves back into the game. And sorry, just to go back to your point before about can Arsenal finish third, it feels, and I've gone through the four in my head the last hour or two, Spurs are the team that seems more settled and they know what they're doing. Now, I think they should have kicked on further, but because they have a reliability, they have a system that they've been using for the last couple of seasons, that is something that Chelsea, Man United and Arsenal don't have. That might be enough to get them to third place, even though they've lost against Newcastle United and even though they lost an incredible amount of Premier League games last season. They have the sense of structure, and to choose the wrong captain, which I think is what we're kind of hinting upon here.
It's also who the other options are. That's kind of the point as well. I'm not sure who they have that's kind of, who really sort of fits the bill.
Well, I mean, you were a player, Gregor, so you know. I mean, when Emery has five captains, what does that? What if you're a player?
It's a very modern approach, and we've seen this. You know, we've seen managers letting the players choose who's going to be a captain. Mm. So it's a very modern thing. I just think that really, when you look at Arsenal's experienced players, there a lot of them are kind of the players who are making mistakes and are sort of most reckless. So I just think that is a worry for Arsenal. I think that's worth looking at now, really. There seems to be, a word we've used a lot already is chaos, and there seems to be that chaos sort of is reigning in the race for the top six. Liverpool and Manchester City swept aside Burnley and Brighton respectively on Saturday. But Chelsea and Manchester United faltered again. Chelsea could only manage a 2-2 draw with Sheffield United. Manchester United were paid back after Daniel James had given Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's team the lead. And at the same time, West Ham got a really good 2-0 win against Norwich. Leicester 3-0 win against Bournemouth. Jamie Vardy scored two, and he's firing on all cylinders. Everton, great win against Wolves, 3-2. Two for Richarlison. All these teams seem to have improved over the summer, Martin. And there was talk about the Big Six being kind of breached this season, at the start of the season. Do you think it looks even more likely now?
No, absolutely. And I admire that Brendan Rodgers and the style of his teams play, and he's carried that into Leicester very, very quickly. Bear in mind, he came at the club last year. Earlier this year. What he's done very quickly is he's put his stamp on the team. Now, they are a team that you think, if anybody's going to take on that sixth place, they might be the one. They haven't got the Europa League to worry about. You look at Maddison, and the two goals Jamie Vardy scored were outstanding. Both first-time finishers. He's created a system whereby Leicester like to control the ball, which is what one of Rodgers' kind of key elements to his style. But at the same time, because Vardy's so quick, and they have Maddison and sometimes Ayoze Perez beside them, they can counter really quickly as well. So they can mix their game up. Defensively, they look quite strong. I won't try and pronounce the Turkish defender. It's very difficult. But I've seen him play, and I thought he was about 35 and found out he was 23.
Yeah.
He really looks a prospect. But again, they paid £20 million from last year, and they've waited for him to develop till Harry Maguire leaves. I think they're one of the ones to really keep an eye on. And at the same time, they played Newcastle in the League Cup, and they only made two changes. And we spoke to Brendan after Leicester had won at Sheffield United, and he said, we really want to win a cup with this club, and stood that up with his team selection. As I said, stylistically, I like watching them, but they really seem like a team that you want to keep an eye on. And there is that possibility of Everton, Wolves, perhaps West Ham, really challenging that fifth or sixth place, because, as we've said already, Man United and Chelsea, your team is very much in development. You think they will get stronger as the season goes on, certainly with regards to Manchester United, but that's not necessarily a given. Chelsea gave up a 2-0 lead against Sheffield United, and Sheffield United just show how much fight they've got inside of them. So it's going to be really, really interesting to watch that develop this season. Obviously, we're only four games in, and the league table doesn't make a great deal of sense at the minute, apart from the top two. But Leicester sitting in third place, Everton sitting in sixth, West Ham seventh. These are teams that, if they can add consistency to the talent that they have a realistic chance of changing the top structure of the English football, which perhaps needs to happen. You need that six to be breached by one or two clubs just to keep the interest going, I think.
Okay, there was another huge derby north of the border on Sunday, the Old Firm between Celtic and Rangers, and we have Michael Grant, Scottish football correspondent, on the line to discuss it now. Well, Michael, it was a typically furious and intense game. Almost escaped without a red card until Jordan Jones absolutely clattered Moritz Bauer in the 95th minute. Last season's opening Old Firm game, which you got me a ticket for actually, it was similar in that there was a lot of talk about Rangers closing the gap, the great strides being taken under Steven Gerrard, but ultimately Celtic superiority was kind of showing up in the end. And you've asked in your piece today why had so few fancied Celtic and why had Rangers been favourites to win? Why do you think that was?
I think what you tend to get in the Old Firm game, Gregor, or the Old Firm rivalry, is that when one of the teams has been second best for some time, and then it looks like it's improving and it looks like it's getting closer and that the gap is narrowing, there always is a lot of noise around them and a lot of claims made on their behalf. Now, Steven Gerrard has been pretty canny overall in terms of his time at Rangers. He's not made huge boasts and huge claims about where they are and how close they are and all the rest of it. I think he's judged it pretty well. But, you know, around Rangers, a lot of former players and a lot of commentators and pundits are quick to talk them up. So, you know, I think that was... there was fuel given to that fire by the fact that they won both games at Ibrox last season after a run of, I think, 12 when they hadn't won any Old Firm game. So, I don't think there's any doubt that Rangers have improved, and I don't think Celtic will feel that they didn't have to work hard for their win on Sunday. But I think the difference this time was that Celtic's attitude was good from the start. Their aggression was good. Their tactics were good. It was a good side. They got big performances from a lot of key players right across the side. And I think when all of those things are right, they have marginally better players than Rangers, and that's what showed. I mean, the second goal was a breakaway goal in the last minute when Rangers are piling forward to get an equaliser. But the first one, the game changing goal was really just a defensive mistake by Rangers, capitalised on brilliantly by Celtic and by Hudson Edouard. And you know, that difference in quality is going to settle Old Firm games just now.
Big result for Neil Lennon too after Celtic's failure to qualify for the Champions League. And as you said, there was a few question marks about some of Celtic's summer signings, but they all performed, and Christopher Julian in particular was pretty impressive at the heart of Celtic's defence.
Yeah, I mean, I think looking forward, obviously, you know, you get the immediate thrill if you're Neil Lennon of winning the game, and that's going to relieve a lot of pressure on him. You know, going into the international break, it would have been pretty grim for him if Celtic had gone out of the Champions League and then lost the first Old Firm game of the season and been 3 points behind. And if they had lost yesterday, there would have been a lot of attention on the signings and the recruitment and the quality of players coming in, bearing in mind that Kieran Tierney's gone out and Dedryck Boyata's gone out and Mikko Lustig's gone out and Filip Benkovic went out. So a lot of quality left the team. There was question marks, to put it mildly, over the arrival. So I think that's what's going to be doubly satisfying for Lennon from yesterday, was that he got such good performances from nearly all of the new guys, or certainly all the new guys across the back. Julien was very commanding, this £7 million centre-half they got from Toulouse. He'd looked a little bit, you know, he'd just not quite settled in, not quite looked value for money, but he certainly did yesterday. The two fullbacks, Hatem El Hamed, the Israeli, who's had a bit of a stop-start opening to the season because of injury. He was very solid. I was very impressed with him yesterday. And Bolly Bolingoli, who they signed from Rapid Vienna for £3 million, left-back, Tierney's replacement, he has had a very erratic and patchy start to his career at Celtic. He was dropped by Lennon for the home game against Cluj when they ultimately got knocked out of the Champions League qualifiers. But Bolingoli played well last night. So, you know, very reassuring for Lennon that he's got some good players in.
Back to Rangers for a moment. Obviously, Liverpool fans in particular down here keep a keen eye on Steven Gerrard's progress, with perhaps one eye in the future. How long do you think the patience of Rangers fans is going to continue before? I mean, the pressure's enormous on him up there, as you well know. And how long do you think he's going to have the Rangers fans on his side? Is it just as long as we're seeing progress, or is he going to have to bridge that gap completely pretty soon?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's going to be essential for him to win a trophy this season with Rangers. It's really extraordinary that they haven't won anything for, I think it's 8 years now, in terms of the three major trophies. Obviously they were in lower leagues for four seasons, but at no point have they really, whether it's a Scottish Cup final or lost it to Hibs. But Gerrard needs to do that. I mean, last season there was a progress of getting into the Europa League group stage, and there was a progress of a couple of Old Firm victories at Ibrox, but they went out of both cups to Aberdeen in Glasgow, which is a sore one for Rangers to take. You know, this season, this summer, there was another kind of swell of belief around Gerrard, and I would say that the Rangers fans, the majority of Rangers fans, still very much buy into having Steven Gerrard. They like the kind of charisma. They like a lot of what he's done with the team in terms of rebuilding it and getting it playing some good free-scoring football in general. But he is a young manager. You know, he's still finding his feet, and there are games when he doesn't get it right. In hindsight, he didn't get it right yesterday. The team wasn't quite right. The tactics weren't quite right. But, you know, you're not seeing the Rangers fans turning on Gerrard, and I don't think they will unless it becomes clear that they're falling well behind Celtic again in the Championship, and also they don't make an impact in the Cups. I mean, really, Rangers need to be winning a trophy this season for the fans to sustain the level of belief that they still have in Gerrard.
Okay, look, Michael, that's brilliant. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Okay, so Newcastle drew 1-1 with Watford on Saturday. Martin, you've written a piece primarily about Almiron today, Newcastle's record signing in January for $20 million, since been surpassed by the rival of Joe Ellington. But he's yet to find the net for Newcastle. But you've written in today's paper that you think he has significantly altered the way Newcastle play with his speed on the counter-attack. But getting the best from him is still going to be really vital for Newcastle and Steve Bruce this season.
No, hugely. I mean, of all the millions of words that have been written about Steve Bruce arriving at Newcastle, not many have concentrated on what his mandate actually is, which is from those inside the club, which is to get Newcastle playing a more progressive style of football and to play a more attacking style of football. To that end, and as usual, there is the kind of there's chaotic sense behind the scenes in that the supporters are unhappy. There is a boycott going on, which means the crowd on Saturday was the lowest Newcastle have had for a Premier League game for 7 years. So all this is going on. In the meantime, Newcastle have spent £80 million this calendar year on three forwards in the pronunciation, which Steve Bruce calls him Big Joe, but it's actually Jelinton. I think Big Joe is easier for Steve. Miguel Almiron and Alan Saint-Maximin, who is injured and out for another 4 weeks. So the idea is to get Newcastle moving further up the field. Rafa Benitez's style was very compact and made the team very difficult to beat. And Ayoze Perez and Salomon Rondon, who have both left the club and have provided 23 Premier League goals last season, which is an awful lot to lose, benefited hugely from Almiron's arrival in January, where suddenly there was space and pace and Newcastle could break with a bit more purpose. He did miss a chance, I think it was in his first game, it might have been against Huddersfield Town, when he hit the post. And many, many moons ago, Newcastle had a player called John Dahl Thomason who missed a really good opportunity on his first game, didn't succeed in Newcastle, and then went on to do outstandingly well with AC Milan. So it's kind of, you're trying to say to people, just be a bit patient. This player is a good player. When we spoke to Isaac Hayden after the game, he said he's a great finisher in training. But there was a nice phrase that Steve Bruce said, where he said the best finishers are calm. They have a presence, they know what they're going to do, whereas at the minute Miguel Almiron is snatching at a chance of panicking. But it is a team, like a lot of teams at the minute, they're in transition in terms of they're trying to play a more offensive game, and Almiron becomes an important part of that. But what Javier Grazi did so well on Saturday was he played three centre-halves, two midfielders in front of him, and there was very little space for Newcastle to play. Whereas the previous Sunday away at Tottenham, there was an awful lot of space to counter, and Almiron had one of his best games for Newcastle. But unquestionably, the longer it goes that he has not scored, and we are now in September and he arrived in January, the more question marks there are going to come upon him. But he is playing, he is impacting upon the team in a positive way still.
As you said, the great win last week at Spurs, and to follow that with the lowest crowd since 2012, just over 44,000. That kind of suggests the deep underlying issues there. What's it going to take for Steve Bruce to kind of, feels like it's going to take something pretty remarkable for him for him to get the fans on side, really.
It's always usually complex, but he desperately needed a cup run, which he knew. But the game against Leicester, Newcastle had seven changes from the team that won at Tottenham, a lot admittedly enforced through injury, but Jellington was back on Saturday. Two or three other players who had missed the cup defeat came back, and the huge gamble of signing somebody like Andy Carroll, who is still, take your pick, between 2 and 5 weeks away from playing football again, means you didn't have a backup striker for the game in the League Cup tie. So Newcastle failed to reach the last 32 in the League Cup. In the FA Cup under Mike Ashley's reign, they have never got beyond the fourth round in 12 seasons, which is a really damning statistic. So when you speak to supporters, they haven't had that glory trail of one season where you're in a quarter final, it's wherever, and you win, or there is a semi final and you've got a trip to Wembley. So you've taken the romance out of that situation to make it a purely hard business transaction, if you like, in terms of we need to finish 12th, therefore we have to scrap the cups, which they actually did once say on record at the fan forum. For Steve Bruce to succeed, he needs to do well in the FA Cup. But in the meantime, he needs to get the team playing, as he keeps saying, higher up the pitch, to be more creative, to be more inventive, to have a little bit more flair. But the risk in doing that is you then start to break up that pragmatic approach at the back under Rafa Benitez, which served the club well in terms of staying in the Premier League twice. So that's the gamble he has to make. On top of all that, Dwight Gayle's out for another 3 to 4 weeks. Andy Carroll is between 2 and 6 weeks. Saint-Maximin is out for another 4 weeks. So the firepower that was supposed to change the way Newcastle played football is not available at the minute, which makes his job that bit more difficult.
Okay. Well, there was a VAR non-decision.
it was a VAR non-story, to be quite honest.
A VAR non-story. Okay. Well, see, we don't want to speak about VAR every week here, but it seems sort of unavoidable at the moment. And obviously the incident was involved Isaac Hayden, who appeared to handball accidentally, but them's the rules at the moment in the build-up to the equaliser. And we've already seen goals chalked off for handball this season at Wolves against Leicester, Manchester City, late win against Spurs. What did you make of that, and where's the consistency?
Isaac Hayden didn't know that it had hit his hand, because we asked after the game. He said, "I don't know if it hit my hand."
Does that matter?
The two managers didn't have any idea that it hit his hand. There wasn't one appeal from Watford players when the incident happened. So there's a nice word Michael Walker used today to describe VAR as disruptive. It's like this noisy person in the class that you just wish somebody would shut up. if VAR is going to come into a situation where nobody is even aware that something's actually happened, then we are crossing the line of a clear and obvious error.
But it's already done that this season. That's the point.
Of course. But this is not a Luddite. But we've had to be so careful with VAR, and now do we want the micromanagement of the game? So technically, if you carry it through the consistent argument, then yes, the goal should have been disallowed. But nobody actually saw it.
Yeah,
there was no appeals from anybody, and even inside the Newcastle press room at half time, there was about 15 different angles of that goal shown. Nobody had realised then that it hit Isaac Hayden's hand. It was only another angle that was shown to somebody on the mobile phone, whether that came through Twitter, I'm not quite sure, to say, it's perhaps hit Isaac Hayden on the arm as it's dropped. So what do we say? Technically, it should have been disallowed, which I suppose, in light of what's happened this season, yes. But when nobody's actually aware that it's happened, that's very difficult to make that call. So,
okay, well, we'll move on from that one, because there were other decisions. And Peter Walton, the former Premier League referee, has written an interesting piece in today's paper in which he says that the Premier League is already reaching a bit of a crossroads with this. A lot of money has been spent on the technology, yet the Premier League are missing opportunities to get game-changing decisions right, he argues. There was a foul on Sebastian Haller, West Ham centre-forward, this weekend. Youri Tielemans could arguably have seen red for a tackle of Callum Wilson. Gary, the high bar, sort of the high threshold is one thing, and it's understandable, but where the technology is there, why are we not using it?
I think sometimes you would like them just to go to the side of the pitch to have a look for themselves and just run across. And as Peter Walton said, it's one in three games on average, the statistics. So I don't think anyone would be... And we saw it last season anyway with the Champions League when Tottenham played Man City. We saw the referee running across and just checking on the Llorente goal. And so it's, if the technology is there, fans are asking, why aren't we looking at that? And should that not be sort of chalked off or whatever. So I think perhaps they probably need to kind of do that. But the thing that I sort of noticed so far with the VAR was more with the assistant referees that in a couple of games I've been at, they're flagging quite early. And I thought the whole point of sort of was to kind of let the game flow in actually to see so what happens with that move. So
we saw that in particularly in the Super Cup between Chelsea and Liverpool. There were some really late flags and the defenders were getting a bit miffed about it as well.
Yeah. But then I saw the Arsenal against Burnley where Darren Cahn had two decisions with the flag. One he got absolutely spot on, was a foot offside, and the other one wasn't right. So perhaps and there was one yesterday where obviously Arsenal thought they scored a win and the linesman got a really wonderful call that Kolasinac was offside. But let's say he wasn't offside and there was a mistake and you flagged, then it's changed. I thought the whole point in this VAR was to perhaps let the move develop and then perhaps look at it. And so maybe you sort of, the referees and officials need to kind of, it's a slow process for them as well to kind of relearn what they've learned for 30 years, perhaps, you know, and perhaps be a less trigger happy sometimes, probably, and maybe refer it. But, you know, I don't know whether people in the stand will get annoyed by every 5 minutes going across or, you know, once a game going across and looking at. I don't know. I think there's a lot of uncertainty still in the stadiums. You feel that no one's quite sure. Are they looking at VAR? Are they not looking at VAR? The communication still needs to be better, I think.
One of the things in the Women's World Cup when England played America that seemed quite obvious is a couple of decisions you thought, that's a blatant offside. But as Gary said there correctly, the they have said, keep your flag down just in case you're wrong, and then they'll get the game flows and we can always call it back. Whereas the Premier League game, same as Gary that I've been to this year, the flags are going up really quick.
Yeah,
it's a different kettle of fish being at a World Cup game against a passionate Premier League ground in the 88th minute when you know as a linesman you think it's offside and you've got 50,000 people screaming blue murder at you. So perhaps that's why the flag goes up, or perhaps it's still some match to iron out the flaws in the original state of the whole thing. What I got annoyed about with VAR from the very start was nobody said to the supporters, do you want your game disrupted? To the people that pay to go and watch football, the magic of a moment of a goal is one of the great... Those goals can be the greatest moments of your life. Now, it gets reviewed, so therefore, we don't know if that's actually happened. Give us 5 minutes, we're going to go and check. So yes, I want as little disruption in the flow of a game of football as possible.
I think the
speed of the game is part of its beauty.
The Grealish one was bonkers, though, when you look at it, because... I mean, it doesn't even look like
this was Aston Villa against Crystal Palace.
I mean, did you think the referee even blew his whistle? It doesn't look like him from the images.
If he says he did, I'm sure he did.
But I mean, it's rare for us as viewers to hear the whistle that loud, and he's in the centre circle, so you have to ask yourself, how would the microphone possibly pick that up? And also, if you look at that one as well, would the referee really have blown in that circumstance if he's meant to let the mood develop and then say, and it's, and even if he did blow the whistle, would you, and I'm not sure if he did, but would there be enough time not for the defence to have been set? I mean, literally, that's a split second, wasn't it, when Grealish put it to the right?
That's a good point.
I can't believe a defender would have heard that and then reacted to that.
No, I agree. I think that happened so... The goal was scored so quickly after after the moment of the dive in question from Grealish that it really wouldn't have affected the outcome of the action afterwards. But if he's blown the whistle, you have to stop from there. So that's more of a human error.
One technical point, you had Max Gow. Just before Lacazette scored, was there an Arsenal appeal for a penalty for handball?
Yeah, there was, yeah. So Danny Rose, handball.
The goal could have been scored, but it could have been disallowed and called back for the penalty.
It happened quite a long time before, and I think they had Sanchez had opportunities to clear the ball as well.
Still appealing for the penalty, weren't they? The move that followed and then Lacazette scored.
There was a corner or set piece that came in, and the ball bounced up and hit sort of Danny Rose's arm, and then they were appealing, and then it sort of all came from that, I mean, I don't know if that would have got reviewed or not, or at what point they would have then gone back to look at that.
Right, we're crawling down a wormhole now, so we'll leave the VAR
chat
there.
Do you like it, Gregor?
I'm yet to be. I'm on the fence. It's hard. I change my mind every week about it. But anyway, finally, Gary, you've written a fascinating piece in today's game about a pretty remarkable family lineage of former Chelsea and Barcelona forward Ida Gudjonsson. Tell us a bit about that piece.
Well, obviously, Ida's father played, and he played famously for Anderlecht and had a penalty saved against Tottenham in the 84 UEFA Cup final against Tony Parks. And obviously, Ida played for Chelsea, and now Ida's three children are playing. So he's got two at the Real Madrid Academy, and he's got his oldest boy, Svenin, plays in for Spezia in Italy. And interesting thing is he said that they've all got good different characteristics. His oldest boy looks a lot like him on the field and runs like him, makes a similar runs. The youngest boys are different, Daniel and Andre, but they've all now got the bug and they all want to play. And it's just interesting to hear him talk about not wanting them to necessarily be footballers, but obviously it's their sort of passion, and they've picked it up off him. And he also makes the point that his grandfather, so his father's father, was also a player, but he was a fisherman in the north of Iceland, and so basically no one saw him. He was in the lower leagues, and he always says he's the best player, but of the family. So, but I mean, it must be difficult for a Gudjonsson to have that as your surname as soon as you get on the pitch.
Yeah,
to kind of have that around your neck of what your father did, what your grandfather did, and plus you're coming out of the big academies in Spain. Good luck to them, and hopefully they do well, but it's not going to be easy for them.
Okay, no, it's a fascinating piece. Okay, well, that's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Gary Jacob, Martin Hardy and Michael Grant. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.